You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Welcome this hour. We're going to be exploring Mars. The red planet embodies a tantalizing prospect for planetary scientists. Its surface is etched with deep valleys and channels that some believe bear signs of a warmer, wetter past. And of course, where there's water, there's always a chance there's life. At least that's how it works here on Earth, doesn't it? Well, last summer, as the red planet passed within 35 million miles of Earth, the closest it has been in nearly 60,000 years, NASA launched two new rovers to photograph and probe its surface for evidence of liquid water. And tomorrow, the first of those rovers, named Spirit, will reach its destination. And if all goes as planned, this golf cart-sized, six-wheeled robot will touch down on the surface and begin its mission of photographing, drilling, and sampling the Martian real estate, looking for evidence that water once existed there, perhaps even still exists, in enough quantity to have supported life. So we're going to kick off the hour by talking with Mars Exploration Rover scientists about the mission from the challenges of interplanetary travel to the possibility of extraterrestrial microbes. But might we have already found evidence for life on Mars? Later in the program, we're going to talk to a scientist from the 1976 Viking mission who claims to have done just that. So let's get things going. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Dr. Catherine Weitz is a program scientist for NASA's Mars Exploration Rover mission. She joins us today from her office at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. Welcome to the program, Dr. Weitz.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm very glad to be on.
Must be pretty busy over there today.
Yeah, it's definitely getting pretty hectic around here. You know, a lot of us have been waiting 3.5 years for this moment, so we're definitely looking forward to tomorrow night.
Chris Voorhees is also out at JPL. He's a mechanical engineer for that same mission, and he played a particularly important role and developing the rover's innovative mobility system. Welcome to the program, Chris.
Hello, Ira. Thanks for having me.
You biting your fingernails also?
Definitely. We're all kind of on pins and needles at this point, just waiting for the spacecraft to get to its destination.
I remember we broadcast from there in 1997, waiting for the first rovers to land, and I can remember that the tension was visible and palpable, as they say.
Yes, it can be cut like a cut with a knife right now.
Cut with a knife. We were actually on the air when the first signals came back. We had a lot of mission scientists with us on the air, hearing for the first time the first signals coming back indicating the landing. Chris, let me ask you: they're on their way to Mars. We have two rovers on the way there to Mars. We've heard a little bit of an update how the mission is going for Spirit. Everything on course, on schedule. Everything as they say in NASA, optimal.
Everything's going very well, Ira, right now. The spacecraft Spirit is about 350,000 kilometers from Mars right now. So it's about the same distance as the Earth to the Moon. And on December the 26th, our navigation team did its final fine-tuning of the spacecraft trajectory, and we are now pointed squarely at our target landing site inside the Gusev crater.
Mm-hmm. Catherine, how hard is it to? Can you give us a measure of how difficult this is from launching on Earth, carrying a successful mission through the wilds of space, and then landing it on Mars?
Oh, it's very difficult. I mean, when you think about it, how far away Mars is, and to try and land it in this target, this 160-kilometer crater on Mars. I'm just amazed that the engineers have been able to do this. They did it on Pathfinder, and they're trying it again now. But it's been very difficult. As you know, one out of three missions we've sent to Mars has failed, so It's always very challenging. But I'm really excited, and I'm amazed that the engineers have done it this far so well already.
Does the apparent, well, it's too early to call the Beagle 2, the British mission, a failure, at least for the lander. Yeah, they're still trying to find it, or at least see if there are signs of life. Is that sort of clouded this mission at all, the fact that it's not working?
The Beagle is run by the British agency, and we've been supporting them through Odyssey as best we can. I think we all realize the difficulties and challenges of landing. They have a slightly different landing system than we have, but we've tested and done our best to make sure that the rovers can land successfully. So We're feeling confident that we've done everything that we can to ensure a successful landing.
And how did you go about, let's talk about this landing site that Spirit's going to be landing in, Gusev Crater. It's a big crater. Where is it? Why did you choose that site?
Well, we actually started looking at landing sites about 3 years ago. Basically, we had two groups. The engineers were telling us what were the safest locations to go to on Mars, and they had restrictions on the latitude band, such as we had to be around the equator to make sure we had enough solar power to last 90 days. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, had to make sure that we didn't have very lot of rocks or too much dust and so on. So the engineers restricted us originally to about 155 landing sites. And then we went to the science community, and they looked at these sites in terms of meeting science objective for the mission, which is to go to two landing sites that show evidence for past and persistent water activity. So fortunately, we have two orbiters around Mars right now, the Mars Global Surveyor and Mars Odyssey, and they're collecting images as we speak, and so they targeted the landing sites that we were interested in, and we used these images to verify or to show that there wasn't evidence of water activity. And so we were able to narrow it down from these 155 sites down to four, and then in April of what is now last year, NASA selected the Gusev Crater and Meridiani Planum, and these are the two landing sites that best meet both the science objectives and the safety criteria for the mission.
Mm-hmm. So you think there might have been a big lake in the Gusev Crater?
Yes, there was a large channel that called Maadim Vallis. It's over 500 miles long. It flows through the Martian highlands, and so clearly it carried water and sediments into this crater. Now, the question is, we don't know how much water was in there, and we don't know how long that water lasted, but there's a possibility that if the water existed there for a long enough period of time, it would have formed a lake, and that lake could have been habitable to any past life.
Mm-hmm. And Chris, what does the rover have on it that will be able to decide if there really was water here?
Well, it's got a suite of instruments, both imaging and spectrometry, as well as ways to manipulate the surface. It has a small robotic arm that's nested under the front of the vehicle that has a suite of four instruments on board, two spectrometers, a micro-imager, and a little tool we call the rock abrasion tool. You can think of it as a geologist's toolkit. He's got a magnifying glass in the micro-imager. He's got a little abrasion tool that allows him to grind away the surface of the upper surface of the rock to see what's underneath, and two spectrometers to give a little bit of the mineralogical information about what it's seeing. In addition to that, the rover has a stereo imaging pair, a color panoramic cameras that, as our principal investigator Steve Squires likes to say, would look good when it's projected onto an IMAX screen. So it's very high definition imagery, as well as a thermal emission spectrometer that will look out over the area, try to see what the area is composed of, and allow us to choose the specific sites that we take the rover from place to place as we go about the surface mission.
So are you going to be depending on what the eyes of the rover see to determine what to look at?
We're very dependent upon what we see when we get there, and I guess we're rich in that respect, in that we've got the color panoramic cameras, and we've also got a pair of black and white navigation cameras that we use to take pictures of the environment that allow us to navigate on the surface, and then we've got two pair of stereo black and white imagery, one in the front of the vehicle and one in the back, mm-hmm. called the hazard avoidance cameras, and the vehicle uses those to autonomously determine whether an obstacle is in its path and how to get around that obstacle. So we're rich in the regards of being able to get images back from the surface.
Mm-hmm. Kathy, if we were on Mars and looking on Earth, and we wanted to send a probe to Earth and look for rocks that would contain past evidence of water, what kind of rocks would we be looking for here? And are we looking for that same kind of thing on Mars?
Well, on Earth, we would be looking for probably sedimentary bed forms. So these are nice layered units, and they can be composed of many things on Earth. We'd maybe look for evidence of carbonates or salts, sulfates. Mm-hmm. These are the kind of minerals that on Earth would form in the presence of water. On the case of Mars, we've identified a mineral called crystalline gray hematite in the site Meridiani. And we know on Earth that typically that mineral forms under conditions where we've had liquid water. So that's the reason why we're going to this Meridiani site on Mars, because we know on Earth that it forms in the presence of water. And so the hope is that when we land at Meridiani, we'll see not only this crystalline gray mineral, hematite, but we'll see other minerals associated with it that support that there was water here. We'll see bed forms, these layered rocks, sedimentary rocks, or maybe even see rounded particle grains that would show water transport over time.
Can your cameras be get that close to the surface or to the rocks to see what kind of rock it would be?
Yes. As Chris was saying, with the panoramic camera, first we'll see the whole surrounding view. We'll get a good idea of what are the rock shapes. And so maybe if we'll find layered stratigraphy in a outcrop that we see in the distance, we can then drive up to it closely, and then on board the arm there's this microscopic imager, and it has it's like a hand lens that a geologist carries around. It can get very high resolution images of the textures that we see in the rocks, and so that'll give us a much better feel for whether these were deposited by water or something different, say volcanic activity, just by looking at the particle shapes and textures.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Jackie in Shelbyville, Kentucky. Hi, Jackie.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Yes, I was wondering, when are the rovers scheduled to come back? Do you know?
I'll ask Kathy, Catherine.
Sadly, they're not coming back. Once they land on Mars, they're going to operate for at least 90 days, hopefully longer.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
And then they're just going to, over time, they're not going to have enough power to stay awake during the night.
Oh.
Once that happens, unfortunately, they die. So the
wow.
Same thing happened with the 1997 Mars Pathfinder mission. We had a little rover called Sojourner, and eventually, you know, over time, it runs out of power and it stays on Mars.
Oh, wow.
Does this sound exciting to you, Jackie?
Yes, it does.
Why?
Because just thinking that we have that much technology to go to Mars and figure out all this stuff about it, really.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to go to Mars yourself?
Not just yet. Maybe one day.
Mm-hmm. But you'll be following this mission?
Yes, I will, yeah. And I'll keep updating it.
All right. Good luck to you. Have a happy New Year.
All right. Thank you. You too.
Are you hoping that kids get excited about this?
Oh, absolutely. Chris? Yeah. I think that's one of the most important things is to engage both the adults and the children and the public, especially the kids, in getting interested both in the exploration of the solar system as well as in careers in engineering and science. And this is one of the ways that we can kind of promote the exciting things that we do.
How long will you know before this has been landing successfully? How many minutes, hours, seconds after touchdown?
Well, what we've got during the terminal phase of the mission, it's called entry, descent, and landing, when the spacecraft has reached the Martian atmosphere and is traveling about 12,000 miles an hour when it gets there, there's a six-minute phase where we basically slow ourselves down and use a heat shield, a parachute, retro rockets, and finally airbags to drop our speed from 12,000 miles an hour down to zero in about 6 minutes. And during that series of events, very critical series of autonomous events, we receive what can be thought of as tones, what we call semaphores.
All right, Chris, I'm going to have to semaphore you this signal to hang on, because we have to take a break. I'm sorry to interrupt. And we'll come back and talk lots more about this final descent stage and what happens. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about the impending, almost within a few hours, tomorrow, landing of the next Mars rover, the Spirit. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. My guest, Catherine Weitz, program scientist for the Mars Exploration Rover mission, and Chris Voorhees, mechanical engineer at the same mission. When I rudely interrupted Chris, he was telling us about those last few moments.
Yeah, the last few critical minutes, we like to call 6 minutes of terror, when we slow the vehicle down from 12,000 miles an hour to to basically zero in about 6 minutes. We do that by entering the Martian atmosphere and slowing down with a heat shield, and then deploying a parachute, which slows the vehicle down even further. And once it reaches about 5 seconds before we get to the ground, a series of retro rockets fire that slow us down from about 150 miles an hour to zero, and we're sitting about 20 meters above the surface at this point, and our airbags inflate, and we drop, and we bounce over and over again, sometimes up to the height that we dropped from, and could bounce for several minutes, 15 to 30 times, before we roll to a stop. And during this series of events that we call entry, descent, and landing, back on Earth, we receive a series of tones we call semaphores that allow us to know that specific events have occurred, that our heat shield has separated, that the lander has dropped on its bridle. And we should know in real time, as these series of events occur, that the system is safe and that it's continuing to proceed down that path.
And how long before the you'll have to do some housekeeping and checking around, I imagine, if it goes by the last mission. And then you'll attempt to actually roll the rover off the lander. How long between those events until the rover can get off the lander?
In this particular case, it's quite a while. During the first day, we've got a series of critical things that have to happen just after landing. We have to get these large airbags that cushioned our landing retracted, and we have to get the lander pedals open. It opens up like a flower, and inside of this is our rover, and the rover's solar arrays have to get opened and get power exposed to them to recharge our batteries. We have to get that done the very first day, otherwise we won't have enough power to survive the next day. So those critical events have to occur immediately. Once we're in that condition, we're a little bit safer, and we'll slow the pace down a little bit. But the main difference between Pathfinder and this mission is the complexity of the deployments that happen after landing. The rover is kind of crunched inside of this tetrahedron shaped lander, and now has to perform kind of a reverse origami and deploy itself and get itself stood up and get its high-gain antenna out and its panoramic mast up. And that whole process actually could take several days. At the same time, we're reviewing the imagery that's coming down from the rover and determining the best way for us to egress or get ourselves off the vehicle. Egress is probably the most challenging thing that we'll do with the vehicle the entire time it's on Mars. In fact, we intentionally turn the hazard avoidance, the autonomous hazard avoidance off during this phase of the mission, because when the rover looks down the lander, it sees things that it doesn't like. So we have to kind of force it to get itself off the lander. So it's a series of very challenging events that will take several days from the point at which we land, get open, and take our first images, to the point in which we roll off the lander.
That's very interesting. Let me bring on another guest. Dr. Gilbert Levin is Executive Officer for Science at Spherix, Incorporated in Beltsville, Maryland. And he is one of the experimenters on NASA's 1976 Viking mission to Mars. If you remember, that was a very exciting mission, having the Viking touch down and those first images ever sent back from the surface of Mars. Welcome to the program, Dr. Levin.
Thank you.
One of the conclusions of that Viking mission was there were tests that were done on the soil at the site there, looking for signs of life. And NASA concluded at that time that there was no clear evidence for the presence of living microorganisms in the soil near the landing sites. But you've since said that is not correct. Am I reflecting your opinions correctly?
Yes, that's correct.
Why do you say that there are signs of life from the soil?
Well, the experiment itself was the labor release experiment, and Dr. Patricia Stratt was my co-experimenter, found all the criteria that NASA accepted as evidence for life before the mission. The problem did not lie with our experiment. The problem lay with another experiment seeking organic matter on Mars, which found none. Hence, NASA was on the horns of a dilemma. How can you have life with no organic matter? Since then, that puzzle has been clarified.
In what way?
Well, people now generally conclude that the instrument sent to Mars on Viking to look for organic matter was not sensitive enough to detect organic matter. And that is the reason that Spirit and Beagle 2 were carrying much more sensitive instruments to look for organic matter. Our instrument could sense as few as 10 living organisms, microorganisms. It took a billion microorganisms per gram of soil for the organic analysis instrument sent on Viking to detect organic matter.
Mm. Basically, the experiment was sprinkling the soil with nutrients to see if any, if there were living things it would make, it would reproduce and grow?
No. The beauty of it was it required no growth, no reproduction, only metabolism.
I see.
We squirted a tiny drop of radioactive nutrient on the soil. Anything alive and metabolizing would produce radioactive gas from it, and that's what we detected.
And that was convincing enough for you?
Well, no, because the most important part of any experiment is the control.
Mm-hmm.
After we got a positive response, we took, as planned, a second sample of the same soil, attempted to sterilize it by heating it, let it cool, and ran the experiment again. And indeed, we got no response. That indicated the first response was biological and not chemical.
And why was that not good enough to convince people?
Well, we still had that terrible hurdle of a declaration that there was no organic matter on Mars.
Mm-hmm.
That subsequently brewed a whole host of theories to explain away our results. And some 40 theories have been proposed in the last 27 years, none of which has ever succeeded in reproducing the data and the control data that we got from Mars.
In the November 7th issue of Science, the journal Science, there was a paper that refuted evidence from your experiment indicating life on Mars. Can you comment on that?
Yes. Dr. Stratt and I have prepared a response and submitted it to Science, so I don't want to go into the scientific detail for fear of pre-publication problems, but I will say that that experiment did not have proper controls, and it applied many thousands of times as much nutrient as we applied. The key thing was they did not attempt to differentiate a chemical from a biological signal by a heat sterilization process. They neglected the comments in our papers that soils commonly evolve low amounts of gas when nutrient is sprayed on them. So what they detected was essentially noise level.
Mm-hmm. Have these experiments been done on any of the other probes that have landed on Mars?
Strangely enough, after 1976 and many times thereafter proclaiming the search for life on Mars as NASA's primary experiment, after Viking and the problems associated with its life detection experiments, no life detection experiment has ever been sent to Mars, including on the spacecraft now landed and approaching Mars.
Why do you think that is?
It baffles me. I think it produced such a headache that for some reason people quail at the thought of going after this number one scientific problem.
Is it a heavy experiment? Would it add too much weight? Would it have any technical problems?
Well, I've designed the experiment and an instrument, and I offered to reduce it to just ounces in an attempt to get it on Beagle 2, but they said there was not even room for it at that small size.
So you stand by your conclusion that the life had been detected?
I stand by the conclusion, and there have been many results from Mars and new discoveries on Earth that support it. We now know for certain there is liquid water on Mars, which occurs at least part-time each day in enough as a film quantity to support microorganisms. There is now a lot of evidence there is no strong oxidant on Mars, which for many years was claimed to explain away our results. And we know that it is not ultraviolet light. We disproved that during the Viking experiment itself. We also know that on Earth, it's hard to find a place, perhaps that little area in the Atacama Desert, to find a place where there is no life is the exception. It would be startling if there were no life on Mars, because Mars and Earth have been exchanging material for billions of years, material that could contain living microorganisms.
Well, Dr. Levin, it's fascinating. Your paper is going to be published in Science. You're not sure when, do you?
We have submitted it to Science, and we do not know when it would be published. But we have published for some 27 years now a whole series of articles which can be seen on our website, www.spherix. That's S. P as in Peter, HERIX.com.
All right. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we await the publication.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Dr. Gilbert Levin is Executive Officer for Science at Spherix, and it's in Beltsville, Maryland, and one of the experimenters on the 1976 Viking mission to Mars. We're talking for the rest of the hour about the current missions to Mars, waiting for Spirit landing tomorrow on Mars. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. If you'd like to ask questions about the mission, we've got Catherine Weitz, program scientist for NASA's Mars Exploration Rover mission, and Chris Voorhees, mechanical engineer for the same mission. Any comments about Dr. Levin's conclusions? I know these are outside your fields of expertise, but this is quite fascinating, this whole debate here. Give us a call. How far away, Catherine, how far away is the rover able to go from its landing site?
Well, we're hoping that it can travel maybe 40, 50 meters a day, but a lot of it's going to depend upon the landing site itself. We don't know whether there's going to be a lot of rocks that will be obstacles, making it difficult to drive the rover. As Chris said, there's these engineering cameras that the rover is going to use to find the safest path to drive with. And so if there's a lot of rocks and obstacles, that might slow it down a bit. But hopefully it will travel over the course of 90 days or longer, several hundred meters, and we'll be able to explore a variety of different rock types during that time.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow, talking about Mars, as we like to do as much as we can, because it's such a fascinating place. Let's go to Aaron in Boston. Hi, Aaron.
Hi there.
Hi.
In light of Dr. Levin's comments, I don't know if my question might be moot, but I've been wondering so long, I just still have to ask. When they send these missions out, or even just in discussions, they're always looking for talking about carbon and water and other things that are what we have here. And I've never understood, with so many infinite possibilities of combinations out there in the universe, why is it assumed that if there were life anywhere, it would be just like us?
Catherine, you want to take a shot at that?
I'll try. I'm not an astrobiologist, but I agree with the comment. I mean, it's certainly possible that there could be different life forms completely unlike what we have here on Earth. So, we're assuming when we send these measurements out that we're finding something similar to Earth, because that's how we know how to test. That's what we know what to look for. But it's certainly an intriguing question about whether there could be different life forms, and therefore the instruments that we're sending maybe aren't going to be able to detect that.
Chris, any comment?
Each time we go to see a new place, it's quite possible that we'll come back with more questions than we started with. But that's part of the process when you're jumping into exploration, and we're still very, very new to this particular planet. And I expect our knowledge will expand exponentially as these missions land and as we get into it.
Okay, Aaron?
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. How do you answer critics of people? Well, not critics. That's the wrong expression. But people who would say, hey, why, you know, if we sent people to Mars instead of just robots, we could come back with lots more information, do a better job. On this kind of mission, do you think they have a point there? Chris, what do you think?
I think the eventual goal of all of us is to eventually send humans to Mars. I think we're probably not ready for that type of adventure at this point, from a standpoint of the technical obstacles that stand in our way. And in the meantime, what robotic space exploration allows us to do is to put our eyes, ears, our senses on the surface of the planet, and expose ourselves, get ourselves knowledgeable about what to expect. It's a good way of preparing ourselves for that eventual endeavor.
Mm-hmm. Neil in Portland, hi. Quickly before the break, go ahead, Neil.
Hi. I had a quick two-part question. My first was specifically, was erosion and tectonic shift very much of a concern when choosing where to land, as far as finding the evidence of the things you're looking for? And second, you know, talking about manned spaceflight, I have so much trouble when I talk to my friends about, they say, why are we throwing so much money at space when there are so many problems here on Earth? You know, and I try to talk about Odysseus and Einstein, but they just don't really want to hear it. I was wondering if your guests had any comments about that. So I'll take my answers off the air.
Okay, fine. What about erosion and tectonics? Catherine, any?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we want to make sure we're in a safe landing site, because if we don't land safely, we're not going to do any science. So erosion is creating big holes and pits and rough surfaces, and tectonics as well. It's creating big gaps and faults and so on. So we were very cautious when we looked at the images to make sure that these surfaces were safe, that they didn't have any hazards like this that would, you know, upon impact of landing, cause destruction of the mm-hmm. spacecraft.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to take a short break and come back and talk lots more about the Mars missions with Dr. Catherine Weitz and Chris Voorhees out there at JPL, waiting eagerly, anxiously, and hopefully for the safe landing of Spirit on Mars tomorrow. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about NASA's latest mission to Mars, waiting for the Spirit to land at Gusev Crater tomorrow, if all goes well. I'm talking with Dr. Catherine Weitz. He's a program scientist for NASA's Mars Exploration Rover Mission, as its MER has been called. Chris Voorhees is an engineer for the same mission. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Andreas in Cape Cod. Hi there.
Hi, Ira.
Welcome.
Thanks. As a software engineer, of course, I'm interested in the computer systems that make the capabilities of the robotic explorers possible. A couple of questions. Firstly, how are the requirements for the behavior of the software developed, given that it's impossible to actually test the behavior of the software here on Earth in identical conditions? And then also, what programming languages are used, and how many lines of code?
Well,
I'll hang up and listen to all of the other.
Okay. Well, we don't have, in fairness, we don't have the software engineers on here, but I'm sure we can get through the questions. Let me ask Chris first. The software. It's a robot, right? I mean, this thing has to all work autonomously, because you can't just in real time work it with this 40-minute lag between the signal coming to Earth and then going back again.
That's right. At the beginning of the mission, it's about a 20-minute round trip time, and that just gets bigger and bigger as Earth and Mars separate. Mm-hmm. To answer the question, I don't have the particulars, being a mechanical engineer on the project, but I can tell you that each part of the system, it is difficult to do what the caller was saying, which is test the system end to end. But what we do is separate that system into chunks and test a particular function, whether it's the deployment of the robotic arm or driving around on the surface and navigating. And we test each one of those chunks ad nauseum to make sure that that particular function works the way that we expect, that the software and the hardware interact the way that we want. Entry, descent, and landing is the same way. We test out each particular one of those functions. We test airbag landing ad nauseum, and then we test the system software to make sure that it makes the right decisions at the right time for that autonomous sequence to succeed.
Mm-hmm. Catherine, if there is a 20-minute lag, let's do a little mind game here. I see a rock. I want to go to that rock, and I want to sample that rock. And do I drive this thing by a joystick here on Earth? And, you know, there's a 20-minute lag. How do I do that? Or do you say go to that rock, and the spirit will know in its brain to go there and do whatever I ask it to do?
Yeah, I wish we were capable of just driving with a joystick, but unfortunately we're not at this point. So what we have to do is when we find a rock, we first have to figure out how far it is. If it's quite a distance, then it's going to take us perhaps a couple days to finally drive up to it. But if it's closer, what we'll do is we'll basically figure out how far it is and identify a safe way to drive there using images that have already come down. And then Spirit itself, using its hazard avoidance cameras, it'll figure out the safest route and make sure there's nothing that'll prevent it from getting to that rock. But it might take a couple days to get there. It won't certainly be a very direct route, probably.
And so if it sees something potentially dangerous, it'll say, wait, I better get more instructions of what to do here?
That's correct. It will figure out that there's a problem. It'll try and navigate around the hazard. But if it can't, it'll stop there and it'll wait for commands from us the next day.
And how deep can it actually sample? Or is it not going to sample the soil or sample just rocks it finds?
It actually has the capability to trench using one of its wheels. It can lock all but one wheel, and it spins that free wheel, and it can dig down about 25 centimeters in depth. So we will be able to sample into the soil using this technique.
So that's about a foot deep?
No, that's actually it's probably a little less than a foot.
Less than a foot. But that won't balance, send it off balance, being like I'm thinking of being in the beach with my car spinning, you know, in the sand there.
No, it's actually fixed in position, and it's only this one wheel that's spinning.
And it's got six wheels that it could.
Correct.
Yeah, it's very interesting. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Eric in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hi, Eric.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi.
Wanted to congratulate the team. I'm a naval aviator who has a training in geology, so I'm one of those big kids who's totally excited about this mission. I want to be an astronaut someday. And I just wanted to ask a quick question regarding the science to be derived from this mission. What do you feel is the most relevant in terms of future manned spaceflight, in terms of, I guess, providing kind of a backdrop or more amplifying information to actually get people there?
Mm-hmm.
I know that, as going out in the field and doing geology work, it's nothing quite like putting your hands, obviously we won't be able to put our hands on it, but on the rocks. And, of course, having a robot there is wonderful, but what is the best thing we can get from this in terms of
yeah.
command equation?
Yeah, what do you consider to be a success for this mission? Just landing and you know, driving around and sampling? What will be the definition of a success? Catherine?
Well, we've targeted these two landing sites because they both show evidence for past and persistent water activity. And so what we hope to do with the instruments is identify landforms or minerals that would support that in the past there were environments where there was water free-flowing or water sitting in, such as a lake, over long enough periods of time, that perhaps these environments in the past would have been more supportive to life.
Mm-hmm.
And so in terms of future missions, if we identify at either of these sites locations that say, yes, this area was warmer and wetter in the past, then this would be a location that we would perhaps target for future missions.
Mm-hmm. And the other rover, which is coming later in the month, the Opportunity, that's going to be landing in a separate place.
That's correct. It's landing in an area about on the opposite side of the planet called Meridiani Planum. And this is an area where we've identified crystalline gray hematite, which is a mineral on Earth that typically forms in association with water. So here, too, like in Gusev Crater, we'll be looking for the minerals and landforms that support that there was water at these locations for long periods of time in the past.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, which side of the camp do you come down on? A lot of people say, well, Mars had a big, wet, hot climate. Other people say, well, no, now maybe it wasn't as wet as we think it was. Do you have a preference of your own?
Not really. I mean, I think what's happening is that as we get more and more data from the orbiting spacecraft, and after landing with MER, we're getting a lot more information about the past, but it seems to be conflicting. There's some indications that there was water running on the surface and sitting in areas for long periods of time, but there's other evidence that indicates that, no, Mars has perhaps never been warmer, and maybe the wetter periods were very just short intervals where we had sporadic water activity.
Eric in Fort Lauderdale, welcome to Science Friday. Hi, Eric.
Yeah, hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I'm very fascinated by all the developments with respect to our going to the moon as well as now going to Mars. But my concern also sort of put a damper on my enthusiasm. One of the concern is that most of the tests that we are making, if not all, are aligned with respect to our knowledge of life, which is in direct proportion to just life around us. Now, what if the life, the type of life that exists on Mars is like outside of the equations that we are using to define life here? And one step further, due to the fact that we have had so many successful trips around and to the planet of to the surface of the moon, and going to Mars, of course it's farther, but it's using much of the fundamental science that was used successfully on the moon. And with respect to Mars, the success rate is extremely low. What if there are life forms on Mars which permit aircraft that are going into remote areas to land, but when they are coming towards populated areas, much the same as we would do, they just simply prevent them from landing?
Ah, okay. Let me remind everybody.
Is that a pattern? Is that the pattern that has been existing? And I would like to hear the scientist's comment on the possibility.
Let me first remind everybody that I'm Ira Flato, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Chris, Catherine, any comments?
I think I don't speak for Catherine, but if we found intelligent life on Mars, I think we would be the first ones to tell somebody. It would be one of the things we'd be most excited about.
Well,
I think in our exploration here, the way that the approach that we're taking is an incremental one. We're looking for the type of environment and the conditions under which life could have or does exist. Mm-hmm. And so in that incremental approach, we can go from one step to the next to make sure that we've done our homework and move on appropriately when we find what we've learned.
All right, let me go to Chris in Cleveland. Hi, Chris, quickly.
Hi, Ira. My question is, this trip or a lot of the trips are based on trying to find where water was. We're sending highly technical electronic equipment to places where water was. What's the possibility that we're going to land in water?
In a puddle of some sort?
Yeah, and short-circuit the system.
I'm sorry to laugh.
Yeah,
I think you're laughing with me on this one.
Yeah.
Catherine, there couldn't be any liquid water there, could there?
No, we know from current environmental conditions that it's too cold and too dry. The pressure's too low to support liquid water under these conditions. We do know that there's a lot of ice on Mars. For instance, the Mars Odyssey has an instrument on board that has detected a great deal of ice in the northern and southern polar regions. So we know there's ice there. We have a mission in 2007 called Phoenix, which is going to land in the northern plains where there's these ice-rich regions, and they're going. It's going to then dig into this ice-rich material and study it in detail and look for organics in it as well.
Mm-hmm. If we're we only have a minute or so left here, let me talk about tomorrow in the landing. What time of the day should we all be peeking our ears, Catherine, to pay attention when this will show signs of life if it's landed there? I don't mean life literally, but that the submission has been a success, at least in the landing phase.
Well, it lands at 8:35 p.m. Pacific time tomorrow night, and it'll be a few minutes before it actually comes to a roll stop. And then perhaps the first images we would get around, I believe, 11:15 p.m. Pacific time from Mars Odyssey. So that's when we'll first start to perhaps see images, but it really depends upon the geometry, how we land. There are conditions where we may not be able to contact Odyssey or back to Earth. Everything will be okay with the spacecraft itself. It's just that it needs to right itself. It needs to get its geometry correct before it can contact the spacecraft or Earth.
So it'll be the wee hours of the morning,
if
any time.
Well, we might hear... You know, around 8:50 p.m. or something, we might get some signals back from the spacecraft telling us about the landing itself. But it may take a while before we get images back.
Hmm. And of course, you have another mission going on for the comet, which we're going to be talking about. Going through JPL must be very busy.
Yes, there's a rotating press conferences going on today for MER and for Stardust.
Wow. And going to be a long night for you, you think? Can you get some sleep tonight?
Yeah, I will try. I'm still recovering from a cold, so I'm hoping that I'll have all my strength back by tomorrow, but I'm definitely going to be awake. Nothing's going to stop me from staying up for this landing.
You too, Chris?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Waiting with bated breath.
Okay, well, we wish you all both good luck, and we'll be paying attention and be following up, and I hope you'll take time to talk with us later as the mission progresses.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. You're welcome. Dr. Catherine Weitz, program scientist at NASA's Mars Exploration Rover Mission, the MER as they call it, and Chris Voorhees, mechanical engineer for the same mission. Earlier we talked to Gilbert Levin, executive officer for science and spherics. Our program is produced by Annette Heist and Trevor Thiem. Charles Berquist is our web producer. And, of course, if you want to know more about the Mars mission, there's a special NOVA broadcast called Mars Dead or Alive that will be airing this Sunday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. You can also surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, and any of the links we talked about today that you missed, you can surf over there. Also, Science Friday's Kids Connection. We have all kinds of educational material free for your use in school. Also, there are real audio files, archives of Science Friday, and files you can download on audible.com to take with you on your Audible player. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.